welcome to the Project School Leadership Podcast. My name is Dr. Jerry Burkett. I want to thank everyone for being part of the show today. And while most of what I do on the podcast, or at least this podcast style that I'm still trying to perfect, is largely for my students here at Texas Women's University, I'm happy when anybody listens. And so it's started to get a little bit of a reach for other people who are interested in school leadership and educational leadership, and that's great. So thanks for listening to my voice and having something to say or watching me on YouTube. So I'm happy to do that. What I'm gonna do, at least for my students here, is April 9th, 2024. I have two classes that I'm teaching this 7-week 2 session here in the spring semester. And so instead of doing two separate podcasts as I've been doing for them, in the interest of time, I'm going to do just one podcast. And if you're one of my students listening in either one of my class, whether it be ELDR 6433 or the ELDR 5323, if it's not pertinent to you, then fast forward. I encourage you to do that. Otherwise, I've got a few topics today that I want to cover that it's relevant. You're gonna like it, hopefully, if you're interested. If not, you're welcome to fast forward it, because I have a couple of things that are specific to each course. But you know, that way it saves me a little bit of time, and it becomes just one weekly episode, and then you can do with it what you will. So there's that. So with that, the eclipse was yesterday. I stayed home to watched it with my wife. And interestingly enough, I mean, seeing a total eclipse, really, really cool. I think I had minimal expectations and relative to the rest of the world as I was watching the news and seeing other people's reactions. And maybe I'm too much of a science nerd or astronomy nerd. Like, I knew we were going to see planets. You had a potential to actually see a comet when it got really dark. So I knew all that stuff. Maybe the general population didn't know that, which is fine. But at the same time, I had some contractors coming over to my house to do some work, and they literally arrived like right almost at the moment of totality. So I missed a little bit of it trying to work with them. And then an Amazon driver pulled up in our driveway too. So I had strangers over, is what I'm trying to say. We had a gathering of strangers during the eclipse, but it was really cool. I got some good pictures. I saw some amazing pictures. So I hope your eclipse experience was cool. We actually got to experience, and you can Google this later if you want, got to see the sun ray. There's a ripple effect that occurred during the eclipse. We actually got to see that across the ground and the driveway in front of my house. It's like these black and white sort of rippled waves that sort of swept across the ground and the driveway. And I saw a few articles on it this morning about what that was and how it only happens during the eclipse, and the sun rays and the light being cut through the Earth's atmosphere and kind of creating these weird waves. So I got to see that. That was kind of cool too. So watching the news yesterday and seeing all the reactions of the eclipse was really, really cool. So I hope you had a good eclipse experience, and you've got to wait another 20 or so years to see the next one. If you're really desperate, and you can see one in 18 months, you just got to go travel to see it somewhere in the Arctic or Greenland. So good luck with that. All right. So on a personal note, I'm traveling this week. I'm leaving for Philadelphia on Thursday for what is known as one of the largest, if not probably the largest, educational research conference in the world. It is the American Educational Educational Research Association conference. This year it is in Philadelphia. I'm leaving Thursday. I will be there until Sunday. I will be presenting. I have a paper that I'm presenting that I wrote on basically what makes an effective principal. What makes an ineffective principal. So interviewed some teachers a few years ago and did this large research project to try to determine, we know what makes a good principal, we know that, but what makes a bad principal? So if you'd ever left a school due to a bad principal, I wanted to know, you know, what was that like? Why did you leave? And just, you know, try to give school districts some tools to understand that not all principals are great, and sometimes these principals stay at schools probably a little too long. And they're running off teachers. And they not may not be running them off, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 at a time. They might be running them off slowly. So what does that look like? So I'll be presenting that paper. And if you want to read it, I'm happy to post it. It is published. It's published in a journal. So that was good work. So I will be in AERA this week. And I'll be available, obviously, always by email, as I always am. So I'll be reaching out whenever I can. I don't expect to be doing any videos. I'm only gone Thursday through Sunday. But I will be available and checking email and doing things while I am out of town. So that will be this week. The first thing I want to talk about today is standardized testing, a topic and subject that's near and dear to my heart. As a former principal, I watched many a student struggle right before the STAR test in some very mental health challenges kind of ways to demonstrate the stress that standardized testing can have on students. I didn't really need to see the research. I actually know what the research says. It's not great when it comes to the high pressure, high stakes testing that what it could do to students. But I witnessed it firsthand. So I have done a rant on standardized testing, and I'm not going to revisit that rant now. You can look back at previous podcasts that I have done where I basically blame the whole world for the standardized testing culture that we have. Unfortunately, though, as educators, we have to live with this. So this is largely in response to an assignment that I gave to my ELDR 6433 students and related to their philosophy of what standardized testing is. So I read through your journals, and I agree with all of your sentiments, and all of you have a variety of sentiments when it comes to standardized testing. And this is related to, you know, colleges and universities are now starting to revisit entrance requirements for SAT, ACT, GRE, and other standardized testings that we use in order to gauge a student's readiness for college. A lot of that was suspended due to COVID because, well, frankly, we lost a lot of years in COVID. We lost a couple of years, and standardized testing was right to sort of suspend, and colleges were right to suspend taking entrance exams before getting into college for various reasons. So even this year, SAT scores are down. They're down across the board. I know this because my son is taking SATs and has been spending the last 6, 8 months preparing for SATs as he gets ready to go through his college journey. So and the reports have not been great as far as where the SAT is right now. Not to mention, and this is, you know, college boards probably should have thought about this, but they're transitioning from paper to electronic delivery of their tests, which may not have been a great time for that. But then again, when is a great time for anything? What I wanted to illustrate, though, with standardized testing is, and I want to make this point very clear. I made it clear in my last podcast related to standardized testing, and I want to make it clear again today that no testing whatsoever should ever be punitive in nature. Period. End of story. We often treat testing as a punitive thing that we force kids into. And then if you don't do this, then you're not allowed the next best thing. Maybe then that's not a test is what we're giving them, or an assessment. I don't even know what the right word is. But if it's going to be punitive in nature, that really doesn't help anything, especially if it's a one-time deal. Fortunately, with SAT, you can take it more than once. A lot of colleges super score it, meaning they'll take the highest of all of your scores and how you do. And that will factor into whether or not you get into school or not, and based upon the admission requirements of that particular college or university. But what frustrates me is that as educators, we're often not the ones that get to dictate the nature of a test. Now, all of my students, for those of you who are listening, the point of an assessment should be to gauge the student's understanding of the content that was delivered, which means, ultimately, in the world of education and how we're doing this, your instruction, your standards, your curriculum, your instruction should all be aligned. They should all have connectivity. So that ultimately that assessment is the tool that you are using in order to gauge a student's understanding of those big three things: the standards, the curriculum, and the instruction. That's what an assessment should be. It should be informative in nature. Here's an example. If you go to the doctor, right, and your doctor wants to run some tests on you, these are clinically based, research driven, shown assessments that can determine what's going on in your body, because we can't cut you open and look. But your blood can tell us some details, your urine can tell us some details, your skin can tell us some details, and even the chemical analysis of some of those factors can tell us some details. I'm not that kind of doctor, but you've been to a doctor and you get what I'm trying to say. So when you give the doctor permission to run those tests, those assessments, even if it's not drawing your blood, but even doing, you know, something inside of the office where he pokes around on your belly and takes the little hammer and hits your knee. Those are assessments. They're tools designed to give the doctor information so that he or she can make a decision about your health care in conjunction with you. So you take that assessment, you take the results of that assessment, and you look at it and you go, hey, these numbers are great. These numbers are not. Let's do this to fix the not. That's what an assessment should be. In education, somehow, we've gotten away from that philosophy. A lot of times, the assessment is, well, you failed. Then what? Well, that's it. We lose the what. The assessment should be informative. It should tell us as educators what's the next best step for our students. I do the same thing for my classes. If the assessment doesn't tell me what I needed to tell me, and I've delivered the learning, then I need to do some self-reflection. The assessment's going to tell me if the curriculum was bad, if the instruction was bad, if I tested on the wrong standards, or if the student simply didn't capture the content in the right way. In which case, what's the best thing to do? Probably give a different assessment. Or go back and reteach. These are aspects of standardized testing that are lost. And unfortunately, when it comes to entrance exams, we don't give students a lot of opportunity to go back for that reteach. We put the onus on them or on their parents. And don't get me started about socioeconomic level and how that's going to impact students who have access versus students who don't have access. That's a whole other problem in education that I'll probably get to in the next segment. But my point is that when it comes to standardized testing, while we have to live with the demon that it is, let's push as educators the importance of not making it punitive. We've got to get away from that. It's got to be informative. It's got to be a tool. It's got to be something that we use to truly assess and move forward to make decisions in the best interest of education for that kiddo. So now I want to talk about the next big thing that I want to talk about is, when did education become so complicated? A few years ago, I went to Harvard. I didn't go to Harvard. I visited Harvard. And while I was there, I visited the Graduate School of Education because I'm a graduate professor and I'm nerdy like that. So I wanted to see the graduate school. And outside of the graduate school, they have posted these banners, and one of them, several banners, but one of them was, education is a human right. So I took a picture in front of it because I truly believe that education is a human right. We wouldn't have the world we have today if we weren't sharing the information that we have. And while so many individuals before us were persecuted or maybe even executed for the things that science told them or information told them or research told them or whatever, Copernicus, for example, you can Google that. We are better off by new knowledge. I have a philosophy, and it's basically new information, new opinion. My opinions are generally formed and shaped by being informed and knowing what's happening, whether it's in the world through research projects or journals that I read, or even, you know, just reading credible journalistic sources of information that I can trust. So if I hear a new opinion, if I hear new information, then my opinion is going to change. I reserve that right. It doesn't make me a flip-flopper. It makes me smart because I've learned something new and now I have something new to apply it to. You know, for example, in higher ed, what we're struggling with is AI. We're just struggling with it. We haven't figured it out, but at some point we're going to figure it out and my opinion is going to change. That being said, when did this become so complicated? I'm looking at a Washington Post article that came out a couple of days ago, April 4th, and it says something about America's legislated itself into now we've got red and blue state versions of education. And what they're talking about is, I'll just kind of get to the gist, since 2017, 38 states have adopted 114 laws, rules, or orders related to education. A majority of the policies are restrictive, about 66% circumscribe or ban lessons and discussions in some society's most sensitive topics, while 34% require or expand them. And some of these are related to human sexuality, gender studies, racial studies, these kind of things. This is not new. The topics of sex, gender, race, racism, and how these things are being taught in school or being legislated basically throughout the country. So here's an example. A 2023 Kentucky law forbids lessons on human sexuality before fifth grade and outlaws all instruction exploring gender identity. On the other hand, a 2021 Rhode Island law requires that all students learn African heritage and history before high school. So look, as a policy wonk, politics kind of guy that I am, I like stuff like this, and I'm not naive to the fact that most of this is driven by political ideology, whether it's red or blue. Both sides are guilty of this. My problem with it is that education really isn't that complicated. It's not. And what I hate and what frustrates me is that education as a whole, it gets stepped on, it gets reduced, and it gets disrespected. We are a science, number one. We are studied. There are lots of branches of education, don't get me started on that, where we go. I've gone the educational leadership branch. I've dabbled in the curriculum branch a little bit. And you know where these things go in education if you've been around for a long time. Teaching and learning, educational technology, and so on. So I'm not naive. I know this is largely politically driven. We've had conversations about this before. But if education is a human right, and everyone should have an access to education, why are we being so restrictive? It doesn't make sense to me. Now, parents are becoming more involved than ever before, and superintendents are having to deal with this in ways that they've never thought about dealing with this before. I encourage you, if you have not done so already, there are two very important podcasts that have been produced about school boards in North Texas, Grapevine, Colleyville ISD. That podcast is called Grapevine. And then the Carroll ISD, and that podcast is called Southlake. I encourage you to listen to both of those podcasts. You can get a sense for what's happening at a local level of how school boards are making some of these very intense changes, largely driven by ideology and some straight up lies. I mean, when you get down to brass tacks, some of the sources of information that folks are getting, they're not credible and they're not good. And then that creates an ideology that doesn't exist and shouldn't exist, which then leads to policies that shouldn't be in place. The problem is we don't have enough educators who are brave enough to stand up and do the research and show that this is wrong. It gets very difficult to convince parents that we shouldn't be banning books, for example, when all they think about is banning books. It has nothing to do with the book, it's what's in the book. And then that becomes a difficult argument. Even if an expert was to tell you that students should be learning about human sexuality as early as third grade, parents still have a problem with that. They have a problem because they feel like they should be the ones that should be talking about human sexuality. And even in their own mind, they might be thinking, well, I don't think an 8 or 9 year old should be knowing about their body. They should probably be knowing about their body when they need to know about their body. So whether that's accurate or not, it's actually not for that person to say, but as educators, it becomes a difficult conversation. How do you convince that parent that that conversation should be had earlier for a variety of reasons? And then you can see the ideologies that creep in about abstinence or no abstinence, or about birth control and protections. And then the religious factor falls into that too, and that creeps in, and it makes our job as educators that much more difficult, which leads me back to my original question. When did this become so complicated? It became complicated because we are public institutions, and as public institutions, we are driven by tax dollars. And because we are driven by tax dollars, we're always going to have governments and politicians behind us pointing a finger saying yes to this and no to that. And it makes it hard for us to maintain our convictions and cling to our research to do what we know is right and what is correct by students based upon our own experience, our own credentialing, and our own education, to then make those decisions that we were actually hired to do. That's what makes it so complicated. But what we can do is to advocate and continue to educate. I think we have a responsibility. We maintain that responsibility as keepers of the knowledge to share the knowledge. If anything, our role and our goal as educators hasn't changed. We need to continue fighting the good fight, continue to teach. I want to challenge you that if you hear incorrect information, correct it. Whether it's in a social media forum, in a general conversation, you don't have to be rude about it. But if you hear something that's just blatantly wrong, correct it. Be confident enough to say, I'm a professional, I'm credentialed, I have certifications, I have education, I have experience, you have all the things that are necessary. Correct it. Hopefully, we can expand education in ways that laws might be preventing us to do. Talk a little bit about servant leadership. And servant leadership is a term that was coined by Robert Greenleaf in the 1970s. He had an essay called The Servant as a Leader. And what grew out of that essay was a movement designed where it sort of shifted this managerial concept of leadership that had developed sort of in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, manager top down. Transactional leadership to more of a reversed role where I, as a leader, am here to serve you. There's a lot of religious connotation to this, particularly Christian connotations to this. Servant leadership is the backbone of my own graduate study. I did my graduate education at Dallas Baptist University. And that was the backbone of what I learned as a leader. Is to be a servant leader means literally to serve others, but you do it in a service orientation kind of way. The needs of others over your own self. So a lot of sacrifice, a lot of selflessness comes with being a servant leader. Conceptually, you have to be thinking more about listening to the needs of others and then acting on those needs in an appropriate way, which means having some empathy, It means having some humility. That while you might be in a larger role, have more education, have achieved more, have more experience, some of those things that leaders could take advantage of in their positionality, what a servant leader would do is then kind of reverse that. That because I have those things, now I need to serve and grow others. Which means taking responsibility for those around you, and committing them to growth. And you can see that a lot of people could have a problem with this. It's like basically, in a sense, like I am going to take what I know and how hard I've worked and where I am today, and now I'm going to take that and I'm going to grow you and make you better and support you and listen to you and help you. I mean, you see how this, it becomes about you. It's no longer about me. It's now about you. So that in a sense, you can grow and become the next me and then take my job. And you see how people would have a problem with that, because, well, we live in a world where money is important and having a house and a roof over your head and a car to drive is important. And if I lose my job because I made you better than me, then what's to become of me? Do we swap roles and then now you grow me? No, it doesn't work that way. So the root of being a servant leader is empowerment and community building and community growth. And so some examples include Mother Teresa, if you don't know who she is. Mother Teresa of Calcutta, she was someone who put the needs of others above herself, even taking her own food and giving it to others that needed it. Mahatma Gandhi, who helped lead in India during as they were trying to break free of British rule. He actually went on a hunger strike for a long time to serve his people. Jesus of Nazareth, which is what a lot of Greenleaf's writings were based upon anyway, that religious Christianity conversation that I talked about earlier. And then Susan B. Anthony. So there's a few of them that you can look at and just kind of see how they live their life. How does that work into the servant leadership? Now, so far we have talked about transformational leadership, authentic leadership, servant leadership. Next week, we're going to talk about ethical leadership. So you can see how some of these concepts blend together. You can see how a transformational leader can also be a servant leader, could also be an ethical leader, and could also be an authentic leader. So you can see how they're similar, but they are different, and they do have some distinct differences. But being a servant leader, it just basically means putting the needs of others above yourself. Some people aren't good at that. And if you look around at some of the, you know, CEOs or, you know, some of them, probably the more famous business leaders and corporation leaders that we have, you may not see aspects of servant leadership in some of those folks for one reason or another. Think about that. That's something I want you to think about as you look around and some of the more famous people. Do they embody any of these aspects that we've talked about in class or talked about in the podcast? Anything at all comes to mind? I mean, I have one I'm thinking of right now that doesn't embody anything, but yet they are very, very successful. But money might equate to success to a certain degree, but behind the scenes may not be as successful as they appear on social media and on TV. So think about that as you explore servant leadership. Is there someone that embodies those characteristics? Someone famous, maybe even someone personal that you know, that is truly trying to live a servant leadership principle? And if this is the kind of leader that you aspire to be, what's lacking so that you can grow? Because in the end, you still need to grow too. So look for that as you continue to study servant leadership. So as a segue from servant leadership, I think it's important for you to know that if you're going to work in leadership in any capacity, whether it's in a school or in higher ed or in district leadership, you've got to work with people. Congratulations. You've got to deal with other people. You may not like other people. There are some people who don't like people. If you're in education and you don't like people, you're in the wrong business. You got to like people. But as we call it in the biz, we call it human capital. And we've got to deal with humans. And sometimes humans are flawed, make bad choices. Most of these bad choices happen in the spring, by the way. The spring tends to make people crazy. So there are a lot of spring mistakes versus the fall where people are a little more relaxed and calm. And maybe it's the weather, maybe it's the holidays that fall into the that happen in the fall or autumn. A lot of mistakes happen in the spring. So as a school leader, whether it's higher ed or K-12, you're going to have to deal with people and you're going to have to lead them to make better decisions. And unfortunately, especially in the K-12 world, a lot of the humans that work in schools have inappropriate relationships with their students. And as a result of that, the Texas Education Agency now requires for us to have to talk about that conversation. And while I think it's pretty obvious what happens to that human being that you've got to deal with, the fact of the matter is you got to deal with them. So for those of you who are in my 5323 class, there are some modules that I want you to visit related to managing inappropriate student and teacher relationships on campus. Now, obviously, I think the root of many of these relationships occurs due to the onset and accessibility of social media, and because of the aids of texting and Snapchat and Instagram, etc., the availability to chat and connect with students in an inappropriate way exists. So that is not easy for you as a school leader to have to manage, but I think it's important that when you step into that school leadership role that you influence your teachers and other faculty members that they are not engaging in those kind of inappropriate conversations on social media. So go through the module, make sure that you're working through that, and then there's a discussion on how you would be managing that assignment. Obviously, the important part is the documentation aspect, making sure that you document everything, take all reports seriously, and then report them to human resources as soon as possible so that they can be fired, arrested, lose their certification, and never be around children again. So, but, you know, that's not always easy. That's not always the case. You're also having to document teachers for other things, whether it's instructionally related or policy related. And so school leaders and principals and assistant principals end up having to do that. So I have recorded a separate podcast on how to document an employee, how to do that appropriately, and the process that's related to that. And I have a module lesson on how to document teachers. So as you're going through that lesson, I have some the companion lesson, defining the problem addressing their performance addressing performance deficits, so that you can have a process for that. It's also some files and documents for you to look at in that module. So it's an unfortunate part of the job that we have to do. And as a school principal, I did have to do this several times, and I've shared those stories with you. That unfortunately, when you're dealing with people, you have to document their ineffectiveness, if it's instructionally or otherwise. We are in the people business, and because we're in the people business, we have to hire people to do a job, and we have to keep those expectations in place. Because in the end, if you're a school leader, assistant principal or principal, your job, your number one job is school safety, but your number two job is student success. And in order for students to be successful, you've got to have the right people doing the job that needs to be done in an appropriate way. And if people aren't doing that, as I always say, as I've heard from my mentors ahead of me and before me, you either coach them up and make them better, or you coach them out. So while that doesn't seem to have a servant leadership connotation, as we just discussed, nonetheless, you've got to have the right people doing the right job. And if they're not doing that job, they've got to move on. And then you got to find someone else to fill the seat to get the job done and fulfill the mission and the vision, which is student success, ultimately. So for my 5323 folks, please be sure that you read through those lessons on managing inappropriate teacher-student relationships, and then look through how to manage human capital on your campus. It's not the most fun read in the world. I get it, human resources. I know we have entire degrees on human resources, and you're always going to have district level support when it comes to HR issues on your campus, but it's nice to have a little bit of a guide when and if, and more like an if and a when, that you're gonna get to that point. So read through that and understand more about human capital. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening today. And what I want to leave you with is my occasional wellness activity that I like to leave you with, because taking care of yourself, taking care of your mental health is so, so, so important. So while I've taught you to breathe and take some time for yourself and go for a walk and read your favorite book or watch your favorite TV show, all of those are great things that I recommend that you do. But you definitely need to get out there and take care of yourself. This week, I want you to try something you probably haven't done since elementary school, unless you are one of those yoga folks. And I've tried to be a yoga folk, but I've got to get some weight off a little bit before I can be a better yoga folk. But if you do yoga and you're into it, great. But I'm not asking you to do yoga. I'm asking you to stretch. Take a moment to do some stretching. If you don't know how to stretch, that's okay. We have the internet. Search for some ways to stretch. You will be amazed at how much it's going to relieve your body of tension that you likely don't even know that you have, because stress builds up tension, which then builds up inflammation in the body, and then that's not good for your health. No inflammation is good for you. So stretching can help relieve yourself of that tension, of that stress. It can help relieve yourself of that cortisol that's being built up. So just stretch, whether you're stretching your arms, shoulders, your legs, your hips, back muscles. I'm not saying get a massage. I'm just saying take 10 minutes. 10 minutes is all I'm asking you to do. Go on Google, find some stretching exercises that work for you and your range of motion, and stretch. You will be amazed how much better you will feel after the fact. Even if you do some simple neck stretches, back stretches, arms, shoulders, legs, so on. Okay? That's my challenge for you this week. That's my wellness challenge, is to stretch. You are going to feel so much better if you do so. And with that, thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. I hope you like this new format. I like it. We'll see how the editing process goes. But after that, thank you so much. As always,